She was there?
Yes, and the Whites never were.
Miss Peregrine got so quiet I was half reading her lips.
It was Fiona who brought the girl to the Hologast, which had hidden itself a safe distance from the Northern Clan's camp, waiting.
I don't understand.
Hugh's brow was scrunched, his eyes darting around.
She was helping them?
Not willingly. I've been conferring with Mrs. Wren and Cuckoo about this, and we believe she was, and likely still is, mind-controlled. The bus accident was the result of a lapse in that control. Fiona tried to escape, perhaps even to kill her captors.
Emma gasped. Hugh said nothing. His jaw was clenched so tight I feared for his teeth.
Damn, they probably want to kill her,
Enoch muttered, then clapped a hand over his mouth. Emma shot him a poisonous look.
No, Miss Peregrine said. The Whites are too focused, too practical. They've kept her alive and gone to all the trouble of bringing her here from Wales for a reason. Whatever that reason is, it's not yet been fulfilled. They won't kill her.
Not yet, Hugh said. Not until they're done with her.
Lamoth was stirring. There was nothing else to say. We rode the rest of the way to Marrowbone in tense silence. We were standing on the street in present-day Marrowbone, just outside the Mining Museum loop entrance, when a tourist paused to snap a picture of us. Lamoth barked at him to keep moving, and the tourist scurried off. Miss Peregrine smiled tightly.
We'll be gone from the conference a few days at least, she said. We've got a more pressing matter at hand.
Lamoth nodded.
I hope you find your girl, he said,
and he actually reached out and shook Miss Peregrine's hand.
Thank you, Miss Peregrine said. We'll do all we can for Ellery once she's well enough to travel. We have a wonderful healer in Devil's Acre, if you'd entrust her to us for a little while.
He nodded appreciatively, then turned and spoke directly to me for the first time.
I'm sorry I doubted you, boy. You've got a rare talent.
And he slapped me on the back so hard I nearly fell over. He started to go, but Miss Wren caught him by the raccoon tail.
If you could try not to start a war while we're gone, she said.
If one breaks out, it won't be us who fired the first shot.
He tipped his top hat and went. A few minutes later, we were re-entering Bentham's attic via the Panlupticon, and the elevator door opened to a strange sound. Applause. The attic was filled with people, Imbrins, friends, ministry workers, random peculiars I knew only in passing, and they were all clapping, their faces bright and smiling. For me. I felt a friendly nudge from behind as Miss Peregrine pushed me out of the elevator.
They know what you did, she whispered, and they're all very proud of you.
There was Horace, beaming and shouting, Bronwyn carrying both Olive and Claire on her shoulders so they could see over the crowd, all of them cheering. Miss Blackbird and Miss Baybax were congratulating me. Even Sharon was there to give me a pat on the back. It was strange what it did to me to see them all gathered like that, their smiling faces pointed in my direction. It stunned me. It filled me with joy. I felt buoyant, flooded with dopamine. I was reminded of my purpose, of all that we'd been fighting for. Here it was, my truest friends, my truest home. I loved my peculiar family, and I knew then that I would fight with them and for them for the rest of my life. I felt Miss Peregrine's hand on my shoulder. I turned and caught her in a rare moment of tenderness, her eyes shining with emotion.
You did fine work, Mr. Portman, she said softly. Fine work.
I stood there, grinning like an idiot, trying to figure out how to hug each one of my friends individually, when suddenly the crowd seemed to hush. The moment I caught sight of her, all else faded. The whispers, the questions, the curious eyes, none of it mattered. My mind felt paralyzed. Because there, right there, pushing through a knot of Sharon's broad-shouldered cousins, there she was. Out of breath and rushing forward as fast as she could, her face at once desperate and beaming with happiness. Nor.
Jacob,
she said, gasping a little as she pushed through a wall of bodies, somehow oblivious to the spotlight pointed in her direction.
You're back. I only just heard. I was in the library with Millard. I was so worried.
I formed a wedge with my hands and parted the crowd, closing the gap between us. I didn't even say hi. I just kissed her, right there in front of everybody. Her surprise melted, changed as her body sank against mine. The rest of the world fell silent as a shower of sparks erupted in my chest, my head. We broke apart, finally, though only because we'd both become aware of how much the room had quieted and how many people were staring at us. I also realized I needed to breathe.
Hi,
I said, grinning stupidly, my face hot and probably beet red.
Hi,
she said, grinning too. And then we laughed. Laughed as relief and joy and nervousness flooded our bodies. We both seemed to have realized that we'd crossed a line of no return, rushing headlong into new territory, past friendship, straight into, I wasn't sure what. But I felt breathless at the thought of it, of what we might be. And then I felt surprised. Surprised by my ability to feel so much joy, terror, fear, grief, all at the same time. My smile faded, and the real world returned in a rush, the room coming back into focus with an abrupt, sobering shudder. Still, the harsh edges of reality seemed softer now. A strange miracle. Nearby, I could hear Miss Peregrine talking to someone in a somber tone about Fiona. Sharon seemed to be heading in our direction. Nora and I still stood near each other, no longer touching, not even looking at each other, but something had changed in the air between us. Then someone started tapping me on the shoulder, and I turned, already frowning, ready to tell Sharon to back off, that I didn't want to talk about loop freedom right now. But it was Horace.
Jacob, he said anxiously. I know you've only just arrived, but we have a lot to discuss. Nora and Millard and I made some startling discoveries during your absence.
I looked to Nora. She bit her lip.
Yeah, I didn't have a chance to mention that part, she said sheepishly. But Horace is right. We have a lot to talk about. It's been crazy here.
You've had a breakthrough? I asked, that familiar hope building in my chest.
Actually, we did, she said, and laughed. That sign I remembered seeing across the street from our house, turns out it was an ad for a store that only had branches in Ohio and Pennsylvania, so we've narrowed it down to just two states.
That's amazing, I said. You're so close.
Not that close. Millard says finding a secret loop in a territory that big could still take weeks. And it's been going slow today because Millard's been working on something else.
Something else? I frowned. What could be more important than this? Nor shrugged. I looked to Horace. Horace shrugged too, and then toyed absently with his cravat.
Who knows? It's hard to pin him down long enough to ask, he said, especially when he insists on wandering around naked like an uncivilized animal.
Some animals wear clothes, I pointed out, thinking of Addison.
I said uncivilized animals.
I was about to refocus the conversation when Enoch pinballed through the crowd and grabbed Horace by the shoulder.
Did you hear about Fiona? He cried. She's still out there, mate. She bloody well survived.
Horace jumped like he'd touched a live wire.
What?
Clearly, he hadn't heard. None of them had.
Who said what about Fiona?
Bronwyn shouted, shoving Ulysses Critchley out of the way to reach us.
She's alive? Oh my goodness,
Olive cried, so excited she floated off Bronwyn's shoulder and got lodged in the rafters.
That's,
Claire stammered, and then she passed out and tumbled off Bronwyn's shoulder into her waiting arms.
Astounding,
she moaned.
Well, where is she?
Bronwyn said, head pivoting.
This calls for a celebration.
She's a prisoner of the Whites, Emma said, and tossed a rope up to Olive. She glanced very briefly at Nora and me, then quickly looked away.
Oh,
said Horace, looking stricken.
Hell. We'll go and get her,
Bronwyn said, her mood ever unsinkable.
We'll put together a rescue team today, this minute. Where have they got her?
We don't know, I said. That's the problem.
Hell,
Bronwyn said, her shoulders sagging. I turned around to look for Hugh. He was still by the elevators, in serious conversation with Miss Blackbird and Miss Peregrine.
I don't understand why Miss Peregrine insisted he come with us,
Enoch said,
when she knew that if we did find Fiona, she could be in dire shape, mind-controlled at the very least, maybe even...
He stopped himself before saying it. Dead.
That would have crushed him flat.
My goodness, Enoch, said Horace. Have you grown a heart?
Enoch glowered at him.
Seems a bit cruel, that's all.
No,
Emma said firmly.
Leaving him out of it wouldn't have been doing Hugh any favors. If we'd found Fiona without him, and he ever found out Miss Peregrine knew we were on her trail, that would have crushed him, said Emma. He deserved to be there, no matter what.
How's he holding up? Nor asked.
As well as can be expected, said Emma. He's a strong kid, but he's angry, and he's worried.
We all are, I said. I turned back to Nora and Horace. So, you have news?
It isn't for public consumption, Horace said. Let's go somewhere we can talk that's a few decibels quieter, and rather more private.
So long as there's food, said Enoch. I'm starving.
It was still early, hours before curfew, and the sun still middling in the acre's putrid sky, and the shrunken head wasn't crowded yet.
I don't generally approve of public houses, Miss Peregrine said, dubiously regarding the tanned and wrinkled head that hung above its door. But as our cupboards are currently bare, and you've all had a trying few days, I'll make an exception.
Go to Hades, you pompous old crone,
the head croaked in reply, and either Miss Peregrine didn't hear, or she didn't want to give it the satisfaction of reacting. We scored two tables in a nook near the back of the place and shoved them together to make a passable private area for ourselves. All my friends were there but Millard, who had welcomed us when we'd returned to the Panlupticon, but then quickly raced off again to attend whatever it was he was up to without saying goodbye. I took the chair beside Nor. Horace was on my other side. Miss Peregrine, Enoch, and Emma were directly across the splintered wooden table, which had initials and epithets of every variety carved into it, and Bronwyn sat at the end with Olive and Claire. I was dying to hear the others' news, especially after Horace had teased us, but he and Nora made us tell them all about what we'd seen and done first. Emma, Enoch, and I took turns telling it, while Hugh brooded at the end of the table, nursing a pint of cloudy ale. The camp, the accident, Ellery and her torn-out worm, Brother Ted and his stolen sparkstone. When we'd finished, it struck me how many odd things coalesced around a single question. What did the Whites want?
As it happens, Horace said, scooting his chair closer to mine, we have an idea about that.
which was right when our food arrived. Of course. Bowls of potato and fish soup were distributed. We didn't have the courage to ask what kind of fish it was, and the barman who brought it didn't bother to specify. Miss Avocet and her team have been digging more deeply into the Apocryphon, Horace said, while Francesca has been working overtime translating a new section of the prophecy that we hadn't understood before. We all leaned in.
And?
Emma said.
There's more to the prophecy than we realized.
Miss Peregrine slapped down her soup spoon with a loud clack.
You should have told me the moment we got back, she said angrily. Now, what is it?
In a footnote we only just discovered, Horace said, before the part about the coming time of darkness, etc., the prophecy talks about the rise of a group it calls the Betrayers, who it describes as pitiless men who tried to pervert the soul of nature, and who were cursed in return.
Sounds a lot like the Whites, Emma said, and Bronwyn and Olive nodded grimly.
That's what Miss Avocet thought too, Horace said. But the next bit gets stranger, and worse. It appears to mention Cole himself, and the Library of Souls.
I felt my throat tighten.
I've never seen a prophecy reference another prophecy before, but this appears to be a quote from the Book of Revelation in the Bible. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit whose name is Abaddon. It goes on to say the Betrayers will resurrect him from said pit.
Enoch nearly choked on his soup.
Resurrect him? And when he returns, he'll be imbued with terrible power.
What power? Bronwyn said, rigid in her chair.
My vision had gone black at the edges, and my whole body was cold.
The corpse under the sheet. Call's voice quoting the prophecy back to me.
The power from the pit of ancient spirits, I said, the empty sound of my own voice surprising me, which has to be the Library of Souls.
Nora was watching me with concern, but I couldn't meet her eyes. I didn't want to betray my fear, not yet, so I did what I often do when I'm afraid. I looked to Miss Peregrine, but our Imbrin's expression was stone. She was clearly still processing.
Everyone looked panicked, and Horace was taking sip after sip of water, as if unburdening himself of these horrors had turned his mouth dry. Only Enoch seemed unfazed.
What a bunch of tossers, he said, and took a loud slurp of his soup.
It isn't funny, Enoch, Emma said with a withering glare.
Sure it is. It all makes sense now. Why they wanted Fiona, and that American girl's madderworm.
He shook his head and laughed quietly.
What are you talking about?
I said, anger starting to rise in place of horror.
It's plain as day, he said. The Whites are following a recipe.
He dinged his spoon against the bowl.
Making resurrection soup, like a coven of witches. Double, double, toil and trouble.
Like she was speaking to a child, Bronwyn said,
That's awful, Enoch.
He sighed, put down his spoon.
Am I the only one who listens to Miss Peregrine anymore? Cole's trapped in a collapsed loop. Forever. There's no coming back from forever.
Unless there is, Olive said. Millard said he was trapped too,
Claire chimed in. Enoch was shaking his head.
The Whites are clearly desperate, grasping at straws. They had no better options other than to slink permanently into the shadows and accept defeat with something like grace, which wouldn't exactly be in character for them. So they're trying something mad because it's the only thing they could think of. But it's impossible.
He pointed his dripping soup spoon at Miss Peregrine.
You said so yourself.
The longer he went on, the more desperate he sounded for confirmation. Now we turned to Miss Peregrine, our hopes hanging on her next words. She looked pensive.
I suppose I did say that, didn't I?
Something in Miss Peregrine's voice made Enoch stop eating. His spoon was frozen halfway to his mouth.
You suppose?
It's possible they're just desperate, as Enoch says, and would try anything. But it wouldn't be like them to spend so much effort on a fool's errand, especially not Murnau. I suspect he may be getting direct orders from Cole himself, perhaps via dreams.
She glanced meaningfully at me.
Mr. Portman's had a few. So have I. Horace let out a little whimper.
Uh-oh.
I snapped my head to look at him.
What's uh-oh? Said Enoch.
Something wrong with the soup? The barman said over my shoulder. Needs more eel powder.
Not now!
Enoch shouted at him, and after the man had slunk away, Enoch turned to Horace again.
What's uh-oh?
I've had dreams about him, too, said Horace, staring into his now empty glass.
You have?
I said. Remember those wake-up screaming nightmares I was experiencing when Jacob first came to us, with boiling seas of blood and fire raining from the sky? Yes? He waited for looks of comprehension from the group, then nodded, swallowed. Well, last night I had another one. Only Cole was there.
Why didn't you say anything? Bronwyn said, hurt. You always come to me when you have nightmares.
I dismissed it as a manifestation of my own fears rather than a prophetic dream, Horace said uneasily. But if Cole's been visiting Jacob and Miss Peregrine in their dreams, too. He dragged a shaky hand down his face, steadied himself, and said, I've never seen Cole in a dream before, prophetic or otherwise, but I saw him very clearly, floating in the sky, directing the apocalypse like an orchestra conductor. He looked up at me. I think it's him and his resurrection that ushers in this epoch of darkness and strife, which I'm supposed to help end somehow, Nora said heavily. Emancipate us from, with six others.
Wait a second, I said. We're getting way ahead of ourselves. First things first. Why do the whites think they can resurrect him? Because they read the prophecy too? Did they assume it was about them and about Cole like we did?
It is about them and Cole, Horace said. Miss Peregrine held up her hands, a plea for calm and reason.
For the sake of argument, let's say Horace is correct, that it is about them. How are they doing it? If they're following a recipe for resurrection soup, as you say, whose recipe is it? What does it contain? And where did they get it? I think...
From your brother, miss. From Myron Bentham.
It was Millard. He was out of breath, having just skidded up beside Miss Peregrine at the head of the table. The headmistress, who wasn't in the habit of asking questions she didn't already know the answer to, was dumbstruck.
I've just come from Bentham's secret office, said Millard, and I think you'd better come back there with me now.
Bentham's secret office was directly above his regular office, accessible via a ladder hidden in the ceiling. The ladder was concealed behind a large portrait of himself, one of many that covered the ceiling, but not, oddly, the walls. At the top of the ladder, we discovered a cell fit for an ascetic monk. There were bookshelves crammed with books, a roll-top desk, and a single hard chair. Bentham's old manservant, Nim, was waiting nervously in a corner as, one by one, we all climbed up.
I've never seen this room before, Miss Peregrine said, turning slowly to look around. Goodness, I asked Miss Blackbird and her people to search every inch of this house.
Nim knew about this place, said Millard,
and the strange little man began to nod.
And so, apparently, did the whites.
Mr. Bentham kept all his most sensitive papers and books here, Nim said, away from peekers and sneakers. But he trusted old Nim, that's right.
Nim was worrying his hands, picking away the skin of his fingertips while his eyes darted around the room.
It was Nim's job to dust, straighten, alphabetize, catalogize.
Can you please get to the part about the white resurrecting coal? Emma said.
And what any of this has to do with Fiona?
Hugh growled. Millard cleared his throat.
Yes, so.
Everyone's always said it's impossible to escape a collapsed loop. All the experts who've studied it agree. Either it kills you, turns you into a hologast while flattening everything for hundreds of miles, as happened at the Tunguska event of 1908, or if you've just happened to imbue yourself with the soul of one of the most powerful ancient ones, as Cole did just before we collapsed the Library of Souls, then you're trapped forever in phenomenon we call esoteric sequestration.
Get to the point, Mr. Nullings, Miss Peregrine said.
Everyone agreed it was impossible, or nearly everyone, but apparently Bentham did not.
Millard nodded at Nim.
Go on, tell them.
Nim shuffled forward, still picking at his hands.
Mr. Bentham didn't want to do it, but Mr. Call forced him to.
Forced him to what? Miss Peregrine said.
Find a way for someone to escape a collapsed loop.
He glanced up furtively, as if expecting to be slapped, then looked down again.
Mr. Call hounded Mr. Bentham about it for years. I remembers. I hears things. Nim was always listening. Nim's my name.
And did he, I said, find a way?
Naturally he did. Mr. Bentham's a genius. But he lied to Mr. Call about it, told him it couldn't be done. But he wrote down the secret formula he'd found and put it in a book, because discovery is discovery, he said, and he gave it to old Nim to hide and told me not to ever tell him where I'd stashed it so it couldn't be tortured out of him, if it ever came to that.
Let me guess, Enoch said. You did a crap job of hiding it.
No, sir, no, I didn't. But they found it anyway.
Millard stepped in.
After the whites broke out of prison, but before they left Devil's Acre, they came here, to this room, and they stole a single book, the one with Bentham's formula in it.
Nim pointed out an empty space on a shelf.
Thieving bastards!
Emma tossed up her hands.
That's terrible, awful. But how does any of this help us to stop them?
Oh, find Fiona,
Hugh said. He seemed ready to tear his hair out. Miss Peregrine had seemed oddly calm through all this, and now she glided across the floor to Nim and laid her hands gently upon his shoulders. He flinched.
Nim,
she said, smiling like people do at children.
Did you happen to make a copy of Bentham's formula?
He looked at her hand on his shoulder, then at her.
Mr. Bentham himself did, yes, he said. Asked me to hide both of them.
The smile grew wider.
And do you still have that copy?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
He blinked, confused.
Would you like to see it?
Yes, Nim, I would.
Nim went to the roll-top desk and unlocked it. It was crammed with disorganized papers. As he riffled through them, Nora raised a hand and said, in a tone that seemed calculated not to offend,
Can I just ask something?
We all looked at her.
Why are we so sure his formula would actually do anything? Just because the whites are desperate enough to try it doesn't necessarily mean it will work. Was this guy like some kind of wizard?
Enoch rolled his eyes.
There's no such thing as a wizard.
Nor seemed ready to argue the point when Millard jumped in.
It's a fair question, he said. Understandable, too, given you never knew him.
Bentham was like the architect, I said.
and Noor crooked an eyebrow at me. Loop science was his area of specialty, Millard explained. He designed the Panlopticon, for example. And he was responsible, we now know, for the collapse that turned Call and his followers into Hologast, and the one that trapped both himself and Call in the Library of Souls.
Okay, I get it, Noor said, holding up her hands. He knew his stuff.
Quite, Miss Peregrine said, but she was looking a bit green, and she was staring at Nim.
Nim extracted a single wrinkled piece of paper from the desk and was now waving it in the air.
Here, here, here!
Miss Peregrine took it from him and began to read. Her brow furrowed almost immediately.
Is this a joke?
Horace leaned over to peek at it.
Quail eggs, jelly deals, cabbages.
Oh no, that's a grocery list,
Nim said, hands fluttering as he reached for the paper and turned it over in the Imbrin's hands.
Other side!
She began to scan it. Her expression became unreadable. Bronwyn turned to Millard and whispered,
Seems an odd place to write something important.
He shushed her. Miss Peregrine's eyes were scanning the paper. You could have heard a pin drop. Then she exhaled. Some of the color had left her face.
Yes, she said quietly. This explains a great deal, indeed.
And then she collapsed to the floor. Everyone rushed to help. Bronwyn lifted Miss Peregrine into her arms. Millard fanned her with a book. Emma snapped a small flame before her eyes, and Horace ran to find her a glass of water. In a few seconds, she was blinking and talking again, asking what time it was and whether the tea had been boiled. When she realized what had happened, she got embarrassed and chastised us to put her down immediately. The moment we did, she nearly fell over again.
It was the soup, that's all, she said as Bronwyn and Noor steadied her. I had a bad reaction to that awful soup.
No one, not even Claire, believed her. She had shown us she was afraid, and now she was overcompensating, because her fear had made us all afraid. After she'd had some water in a minute to regain her composure, she sat down at Bentham's desk. We were dying to know what was on the back of Bentham's grocery list. She flattened it before her. It was wrinkled and stained with something that looked like coffee, and she said,
I don't want to keep you in undue suspense. So sit and listen.
We sat around her in a circle on the floor, like kindergartners at the most stressful story time imaginable. Noor sat close to me, her proximity a balm, even as she clenched and unclenched a nervous fist through the air in front of her, collapsing and reviving the light.
The top line is written in Latin, said Miss Peregrine,
and then she read it in Latin. Noor and I exchanged a look, but no one else seemed bothered. I raised a hand before Miss P moved on. She peered at me. I cleared my throat. Can you translate, please? Even now, in the middle of all of this, Miss Peregrine found the time to pause long enough to look disappointed in me.
Really, Mr. Portman, she said, shaking her head.
And then, it says, To summon a soul from deep in the pit, you will need, well, all of it.
Your brother was no poet, said Millard.
And with that, the list begins.
She cut her eyes at me.
In English, there are only 6 items.
What followed was not so unlike the list of groceries written on the reverse, only these ingredients were more esoteric and disturbing.
1. Castings of the Uberworm.
Uberworm. My head snapped toward Emma and Enoch, who were already looking over at me. What was it Ellery said they took from her?
Her madderworm, said Enoch, which I can only guess is a big, nasty worm, said Emma.
Bronwyn blew out her breath.
So That's one ingredient they have.
Shall I read on? Miss Peregrine said. 2. Tongue of the seed sprout, freshly harvested.
What's a seed sprout? Asked Olive.
Miss Peregrine looked pained.
Fiona, she said. It's an archaic term for her type of peculiar.
Hugh's face fell into his hands.
Harvested fresh, Millard said. Which must be why they're keeping her alive.
Millard, please, Miss Peregrine hissed. I'm sorry, Hugh.
Go on, keep reading, he said.
He uncovered his face, eyes red. Bronwyn wrapped an arm tight around him and kept it there.
3. An indestructible flame.
We traded murmurs, trying to figure it out.
Could that mean Emma? Horace guessed.
Enoch let out an audible gasp.
Perhaps if I were immortal,
Emma shook her head.
But I'm not indestructible, so how could my flame be?
And then it came to me. The boy in the blankets, in Locust Gap. Emma's eyes lit up.
Yes, he was horribly cold and used to have a thing that kept him warm, a flaming rock in his stomach.
The Sparkstone, Miss Peregrine said, cocking her head at Emma curiously.
There is only one in the world.
And some white stole it months ago, Emma said. We hadn't told Miss Peregrine about the boy, but she understood immediately and nodded in resignation.
That's 3 they have.
She returned to the list.
4. Death beetles of the underground Hittites.
Nim's hands clapped over his mouth.
Oh!
We all turned toward him.
What is it? Millard said sharply.
Nim's cheeks had gone pink.
They were under glass in Mr. Bentham's collection. Until the other night.
When they were stolen by Murnau and his cronies, I guessed.
Well, given the timing of their disappearance,
he stammered.
Yes, yes, I'm afraid so.
Groans and murmurs went up. Enoch swore. Nor had gone very still and quiet. Millard was muttering to himself that this was worse, much worse than he'd thought, and Miss Peregrine pinched the bridge of her nose and squeezed her eyes shut, as if chasing away a bad headache.
My God,
Horace said, panic rising in his voice.
They've collected nearly everything on the list. What's left?
Please, everyone, we mustn't lose our heads, said Miss Peregrine. There are 2 items remaining. The room went silent. She flattened the paper on the desk again and squinted at it uncertainly, like she couldn't quite decipher Bentham's handwriting. Then she said,
5. The alpha skull of the Well of Hope, powdered 5 to 10 milligrams.
Everyone was frozen, watching the others, waiting for bad news, waiting for someone to say that the whites already had the alpha skull, or that alpha skulls were so common they practically grew on trees, or that alpha skull, powdered 5 to 10 milligrams, was so easy to find it was sold in bulk at Costco, and the only thing standing in between the whites and the resurrection of Call was a Costco club membership card. But no one was saying anything.
What's the Well of Hope?
Nora ventured finally. We all looked to Miss Peregrine.
I've no idea.
She turned to Enoch.
Mr. O'Connor, you're our expert in all manners thanatotic. Ever heard of an alpha skull?
Enoch shook his head blankly. Miss Peregrine shrugged.
1 left, then. 6. Beating heart of the mother of birds.
There were audible gasps. She looked up quickly.
And before you jump to any...
That means you, miss, cried Claire.
They're going to come for you,
Horace wailed.
Horace, Claire, stop that, Miss Peregrine snapped. It does appear to reference an Imbrin, but I'm not the eldest, nor even the maternal figure amongst us. If anyone, that's Miss Avocet.
But you're our mother, or close as we've got, said Emma.
And Fiona's,
said Hugh.
And she's on the list too.
And your Cole's sister, Millard pointed out. His actual flesh and blood. It makes a terrible kind of sense that he'd need part of you to come back.
I waited for her to argue, for her to tell Millard how mistaken he was. But she was quiet. Her eyes searched a blank wall. Then she said,
Yes. Yes, I suppose that does make sense.
There was a long, heavy moment when it felt like we were slipping over the edge, giving up, giving in to fear. And then Hugh spoke.
It doesn't matter, he said. We'll never let them take you.
And there was such iron in his voice, such unpanicked firmness, that it seemed to pull the rest of us back from the brink.
That's right, said Olive.
Never, agreed Bronwyn.
And if they haven't come for you yet, said Millard, it's because you're the hardest bit, and they're saving you for last. So far as we know, they haven't got this other piece yet, the Alpha Skull.
Whatever the hell that is, said Enoch.
Miss Peregrine stood up from the desk, steady on her feet now.
Then we will find out what the hell it is, she said, and we will stop the whites from getting it.
And get Fiona back, said Bronwyn.
And decorate Devil's Acre with their heads, cried Hugh,
and a cheer went up. For the first time in days, I saw him crack a wavering smile. Chapter 10. We were now in the frustrating position of having a clear goal, find this skull and the Well of Hope before the whites did, but no clear way to achieve it. Tracking the whites via hollow residue had become nearly impossible. They had fled the scene of the bus accident in a car, presumably, and there was no way of knowing which way they'd gone. Nobody had ever heard of either the skull or the well, and until we had some idea about the location of at least one of them, we were effectively paralyzed. True to form, Miss Peregrine wanted the Imbrins to handle the entire problem and told us to go back to the house and stay there while she conferred with them.
You must all get some rest, she said. We have a fight ahead of us, and I need you in top shape.
And in a great feather burst, she assumed bird form and winged off. Rest be damned. It was unthinkable anyway, with all this hanging over our heads, so we splintered apart and went to work. Millard rushed off to the mapping archive to search American loop atlases for any mention of the Well of Hope. Horace, for whom sleep and work were often the same thing, actually did go back to the house to rest. His plan was to down a dram of sleeping solution and put himself into a trance-like slumber, where he hoped to dream the answer we needed. Hugh had been muttering darkly about interrogating the whites who were still imprisoned.
They know something, he'd said,
and threatened to sting it out of them if they won't talk.
But cooler heads prevailed, arguing that not only would that break a number of Imbrin code laws, but revealing anything about what we knew to whites, even jailed ones, could jeopardize everything. Then Claire said she'd worked with some peculiars in the Department of Arcane Fauna who had lived in America years before and ran away to ask them if they'd ever heard of an Alpha Skull or the Well. At which point, something obvious occurred to me. If we think this thing is in America, I said, why don't we just ask the Americans? Lamoth owes me a favor. So we made our way to Bentham's attic in the Marrowbone Loop entrance, only to find the elevator blocked by a black-clad wall of temporal affairs minions.
Oh, no, you don't, Ulysses Critchley said, holding up the flat of his hand like a school crossing guard. Miss Peregrine just left and gave us strict instructions not to admit you or anyone else. Miss Wren and Miss Cuckoo have been apprised of the situation, and they're with the Americans now.
I was about to start arguing with him when Olive pointed out that Hugh and Enoch were gone. We spun around to look, and she was right.
Emma was so mad she nearly lit her own shirt sleeve aflame.
I know just where they went, she growled. Come on, Bronwyn, let's stop them before they do something monumentally stupid.
Which left Nor, Olive, and me to our own devices. It was clear we weren't getting into Marrowbone, and anyway, two Imbrans were more than capable of getting information out of the Americans, if there was any to be gotten. We spent an hour wandering the acre, feeling helpless. We were so close, and yet... Eventually, we all found our way back to the house. Nobody had come up with anything useful. Millard hadn't found anything in the Imbrans' collection of American loop maps, and he was abundantly familiar with them now, after days of combing them for V's loop. Horace, despite his best efforts to force a revelation, had, much to his embarrassment, only dreamed of pizza. No one else had anything to show for their efforts, and Miss Peregrine hadn't returned. We were a sad group. I took in my friends' gaunt faces, Hugh's devastation, Emma's exhaustion, Nora's anxiety, even Enoch's lethargy, and I made a decision. None of us were going to get any sleep tonight anyway. All right, I clapped my hands together. We tried, right? We tried to find more information while following the rules, didn't we? Gave it our best shot? No one answered, and still I nodded, mostly to myself. Well, the night is young. I think there's enough time to try one last thing. One by one, my friends looked up at me, eyes blinking, confusion mounting.
I don't understand, Claire said, both mouths yawning. Nor I, said Olive, yawning too.
I do, Hugh said, his shoulders straightening. I understand you clearly, Jacob, and I'm inclined to agree with you.
And me, Nor said, smiling. That smile pierced me straight through the heart, messed up my insides. I loved it. I smiled back at her, big, stupid. And then, remembering myself, I smiled at the others, too. Bronwyn had narrowed her eyes at me, her mind clearly at work, and then, suddenly, she turned.
Olive, she said, tossing the words over her shoulder, would you be a dear and take Claire to bed, please? It's well past your bedtime, and you know how Miss Peregrine likes you both to be asleep at 8 o'clock on the button.
All right,
Olive said, stifling another yawn.
Come along, Claire,
she said, taking the other girl by the hand. They were already halfway up the stairs, Olive's metal boots clomping on the wood, when I heard Claire's voice, soft and echoing.
But we read that one last time, she was saying. You promised that tonight we'd read the terrible tale of the Grim Bear and the 9 Noisy Normals. Or, oh, maybe we can read The Witch That Wouldn't Burn. That one is my favorite.
Only when the littlest ones were safely off to bed did the others turn to face me. Enoch, Bronwyn, Emma, Horace, Hugh, Nor, Millard. 6 pairs of eyes blinking at me. A 7th pair, invisible. All right, then, I said. Who wants to help me break into the Marrowbone loop? 6 hands shot up into the air.
My hand is raised too, Millard said.
I smiled so wide, my face hurt. The sun had long since sunk beneath the grimy horizon, and in the absence of light, Devil's Acre became particularly gruesome. We had no youthful interest in breaking curfew to wander the streets at this hour. We simply had no choice. In order to make our way back to Bentham's attic and the Marrowbone loop entrance, and to reduce our chances of being spotted by the home guard along the way, we had to cross through the sketchiest part of town, which meant dealing with the dirtiest scraps of people, the ambrosia addicts, the wiliest thieves, all the unimaginable horrors lurking in the muck. Emma lit a small flame to keep us from being plunged too fully into the thick of it, but Millard snapped at her to shut it off, lest we be rounded up by the authorities.
"The steep fines notwithstanding," he shout whispered, "I've no interest in sleeping naked on the cold floor of a prison, thank you very much."
"Then maybe you should start wearing clothes," Horace said archly. "I've offered dozens of times to dress you, and yet..." Millard groaned.
"Quiet, both of you," Emma said. "We've got to keep our wits about us, and there's no chance of that with the two of you sniping at each other."
Bronwyn sighed.
"Bentham's house seems much farther away in the dark, doesn't it? Are you sure we haven't passed it?"
"We're not far now," Hugh said quietly.
I heard the buzz of his bees, who were helping guide us in the darkness.
"We turn left at the lamp, and it should be just up the street from there."
Since there was only one street lamp currently lit, it was easy to spot. But it was still at least 1,000 feet away, 1,000 feet of creeping, slithering night. Something actually seemed to hiss in the distance. We pressed onward, this time silently, the seven of us hemmed in by the dark, and by fear, too. By fear, perhaps most of all. Just then, I felt a strange, warm breeze against my hand. I looked down, startled, to find an isolated dot of light illuminating my palm. I stopped in place, lifting my palm upward, inspecting the tiny glow. And I was just about to say something about it to the group when Noor came up beside me. I felt it right away. I knew it was her without the visual confirmation. I could feel the sparks in my head signaling her nearness.
"I was just trying to find you," she said softly,
taking my hand to draw me nearer. The glow slipped away between our linked fingers. She whispered as we walked,
"I hope I didn't freak you out."
My spine felt like a live wire. I shook my head no, forgetting she probably couldn't see me do it. But I felt kind of dazed. I don't know why this felt different, more extraordinary. In my limited experience, holding hands with a girl had never been particularly memorable. But tonight, my nerves were unusually sensitive. I couldn't see anything but the blurred gaslight humming in the distance, and with one sense gone, the others had awakened. Noor's grip on my hand was making me lose my grip on everything else. I wanted to tell her to let go, to give me my head back. I wanted to hold on forever. I took a single, shaky breath to clear my thoughts when three things happened at once. Millard said,
"Nearly there!"
Hugh, no, Horace, screamed. And Emma caught fire. That last one happened only for a second, and Emma was clearly embarrassed by it because she couldn't put it out fully. She was flustered, muttering about how Horace had startled her, and why had he screamed anyway? Everything was fine, wasn't it? But the flames kept jumping from her arm to her leg to the top of her head, and then finally to the tips of her fingers, 10 birthday candles that refused to extinguish. She was still shaking her hands, the vigorous motion only making the flames worse, when Horace explained.
"I just remembered," he said. "I just remembered."
"Remembered what?" Emma said, irritated, as she began to snuff out her little fires.
"The lamplight. I was staring at it, and it reminded me of my dream, of a detail I'd overlooked. Do you remember when I said that I saw Cole was floating in the sky, directing the apocalypse?"
"Like an orchestra conductor. Yes, we heard," Millard muttered. "Don't you pay him any mind, Horace," Hugh said. "Go on."
"Well, he was floating in the sky, but the sky was above a hill. The sun was blazing, the lamplight triggered that bit, and I remember now that there were graves nearby, inscriptions on said graves. I'm seeing it now, seeing it clearly. The name of an American city. Something new."
A new city, you mean? Millard again. But new compared to what? Anything can seem new depending on the historical context.
Good point,
Enoch said, sounding annoyed. And then he yawned loudly.
Can we get going?
I'm freezing and hungry, and I thought we'd be having more fun by now. You're only being unkind to hide your fear, Bronwyn said to him. And that's not fair to the rest of us. We're all scared, you know.
I'm not scared, Enoch snapped.
Wait, said Noor. Wait, wait. And I heard the frown in her voice when she said, You said it was a new American city. Do you mean new like New York? Horace gasped.
Yes,
said two people at once. The first was an exhilarated Horace. The second, Emma struck a new flame, the light of which illuminated both her fear and R. Imbrin's anger. Miss Peregrine. Not just her, either. A flock of Imbrins had descended upon us. Miss Peregrine, Miss Wren, Miss Cuckoo, Miss Blackbird. The Imbrins had come back from Marrowbone.
Back to bed, all of you, Miss P said angrily. Now, this instant.
But, Miss, we were only...
Enough, she said, breathing hard. Breaking curfew? Deliberately disobeying my orders? I am more than shocked, Miss Bruntley. I am extremely disappointed. Now turn around and head home at once.
But, Miss, Hugh tried, was there any news?
A beat of silence.
Yes.
Does it have to do with New York? Horace asked. Miss Peregrine sighed. The fight seemed to leave her.
Very well, she said. We can talk about it back at the house. I'm sorry for shouting, children. It's been a very tiring evening.
It's all right, miss, Emma said. You've been dealing with so much. We'll go back home and Horace will make you a nice cup of chocolate, won't you, Horace?
I'd be delighted.
Brown noses,
Enoch muttered.
What was that, Mr. O'Connor?
Nothing, miss.
Indeed.
Miss P took a sharp breath.
Imbrins, shall we meet back at the house?
A violent shuddering of wings was the only response. We were all of us, children and Imbrins, settled in the living room, clutching hot cups of chocolate, when Miss Peregrine finally broke the news. Well, Miss Peregrine allowed Miss Wren to break the news. Regardless, we were on tenterhooks. Miss Wren took a step forward from the gaggle of Imbrins.
The Americans finally gave us some information we believe we can act on. There is, in the upper portion of the American state of New York, a town called Hopewell. And in that town, there is a loop of dead risers.
New York! Horace shouted. That's what I saw on the stone in my dream!
He and Noor shared an awkward but enthusiastic high five.
And Hopewell, Bronwyn cried. Well of hope!
Why wouldn't Bentham's list just say that then? Emma said.
My brother loved puzzles, Miss Peregrine said, and I'm sure he was trying to frustrate Call by encoding his list a bit, in case it was discovered.
And the Alpha Skull, Millard said.
If we're looking for a special skull, a loop of dead risers isn't a bad place to start, said Enoch. What do you know about them?
Not much, said Miss Cuckoo, only that they are quite isolated and don't welcome visitors.
Sounds like my kind of people.
Hugh banged his hand on a table suddenly.
We've got to raise an army and storm this place. Come in with guns blazing.
Not so fast, said Miss Peregrine. I understand passions are running high, but we don't know what we'll find in this loop, whether or not the whites have been there already, what kind of peculiars we'll be dealing with. We need to tread carefully, but prepare ourselves for a conflict.
The whites could be waiting with an army, Bronwyn said.
They don't have an army, Enoch said dismissively. It's just a handful of fugitives.
And a holocaust,
said Olive.
Maybe more than one, I added.
It wouldn't be wise to underestimate them, Miss Peregrine said. That's why we've already begun to assemble an elite team of our very best peculiars for this mission.
Emma crossed her arms and frowned.
Who?
Miss Peregrine smiled.
You, of course. You're the ones who liberated Devil's Acre, said Miss Wren. There's no one with better experience or preparation than you all.
We were all grinning now, beaming with pride.
You'll have backup, of course, Miss Peregrine hastened to add, a support team.
Us, said Miss Cuckoo, and a few other peculiars hand-picked for their special skills.
I've got some Grimbears who've been itching for a little exercise, said Miss Wren, and a detachment of the Home Guard is already making preparations.
But you'll be the vanguard, said Miss Peregrine.
If you're willing to give it a go, that is, said Miss Cuckoo.
Are you serious?
Bronwyn said.
We'd have gone even if you forbade it.
And chained us in a dungeon, added Hugh.
I know, Miss Peregrine said proudly. Well, we have a great deal ahead of us, don't we?
Let's go murder some whites,
Hugh shouted, and the room exploded into cheers.
Yes, yes, but first, sleep.
Miss Peregrine stood up.
Off to bed, children, and don't forget to brush your teeth.
Everyone groaned. The house was a buzzing hive in the morning, everyone running around, squeezing past one another on the stairs, gathering whatever small items they thought might be needed for a dangerous mission. Food, extra clothes, a favorite knife, whatever could fit in a pocket or a small bag. None of us had much anyway. I was scrounging in the boys' common dresser for some fresh socks. Nor went to splash some water on her face.
I'd kill for another shower, she said, but you can't have it all.
I ran after her. Hey, I said, can we talk for a second? She finished drying her face, looked at me, and frowned.
I know what you're going to say, she said. The answer is forget it.
What was I going to say? She pulled me into an empty room.
That I don't have to do this. That maybe I should just stay here where it's safe. But I can handle myself.
I know you can, but this isn't your fight. Or it doesn't have to be. She was shaking her head, starting to get angry. If you'd rather just focus on finding V, I said, I would understand.
Were you serious when you said I was one of you guys?
She said.
Or was that just some line?
Of course you're one of us.
Then this affects me just as much as it does you. Actually more, because if we don't shut these assholes down now before they resurrect their devil king or whoever, it sounds like it's me who's going to be dealing with the mess they make. I'd rather get on that before they start the apocalypse.
Okay. I said. Good point.
I will find V when this is over. Right now, this is my fight, and I'm not going anywhere. So no more of this, it's cool if you stay behind and twiddle your thumbs while we risk our lives stuff, okay? We're in this together.
Okay, I said. We're a team. She beamed.
We're a team.
Yep. And just in case there is an apocalypse, there's no way in hell I'm letting you handle it without me. She broke into a smile.
Okay, she said, but let's try to avoid that.
Okay. I laughed. Enoch came into the hall.
Come on, lovebirds. We're leaving.
Chapter 11. An hour later, we were flying down an American highway in a small convoy of SUVs. It was night, and it was raining. There was a heavyset man from Temporal Affairs at the wheel. Miss Peregrine was beside him in the passenger seat, knitting something in her lap. Nora and Millard and I were on the bench in the middle row. Enoch, Emma, and Bronwyn were in the back.
The rest of our friends and the other Imbrans were in another SUV behind us. The backup they'd promised was in an SUV behind that, and somewhere in the slashing rain was an American escort. It was the Americans who'd lent us the cars. We had taken the Penloop de Condor to New York, where Leo promised us safe passage. The Imbrans had told him that Noor had been tracked down by me and was staying with us now, though they allowed Leo to continue believing it was a white who had used a hologast to break Noor out of his loop rather than H. Astoundingly, he agreed to let the whole matter drop, and as part of the Americans' deal with the Imbrans, he promised never again to send his men after Noor. Noor and I could hardly believe it. Miss Wren refused to say what the Imbrans had promised in return for all this, but it must have been something good. As we drove, my friend's excited fervor had settled into a tense quiet. No one had spoken in minutes. Noor's left hand was on my knee, fingers laced through mine. With her right hand, she played with the headlights of passing cars, scooping the light up and letting it seep out of her fist, scooping it up, letting it out. I found it hypnotic and calming. "There's something I've been wondering," Emma said, her sudden words in the silence startling me. "What's that?" Noor said. "Why was Cole so obsessed with finding a way out of a collapsed loop?" "Hmm," Millard said, his thinking noise. "Was he expecting to get trapped in a collapsed loop one day?" "No one expects to get trapped in a collapsed loop," Bronwyn said. "Maybe it was just a precaution." "If so, it was a very specific one," Millard said.
"He clearly knew about the prophecy," Noor said, bending the light between her fingers. "If he thought that Angel of the Pit stuff was about him, maybe he assumed it was his fate to get trapped."
"What if it was part of his plan?"
Millard seemed to be testing out a theory.
"To be buried in the Library of Souls."
"That's ridiculous," I said. "He didn't want that to happen. He was furious."
"Maybe that's exactly what he wanted us to think."
"Oh, hell," Enoch said. "You lot have gone around the bend."
"Think about it."
Millard's tone was heavy, serious.
"He was always talking about the old powerful peculiars, how they were the most pure expression of peculiarhood, etc. That's why he wanted the library, to mine it for its powers. But maybe the only way he could really do that was if he was buried in it, then resurrected from it with all the powers of the library at his fingertips."
"Born again," Emma whispered loudly. "As a god."
I got chills. Miss Peregrine clacked her needles together.
"My brother was a power-hungry madman with a poisoned soul, but he was not and will never be a god."
"But he's been preparing for this," Emma said. "They all have."
"Even if he has, he isn't back yet, and we're not going to let him come back. So there's no need to spin out terrifying speculations and work ourselves into a lather."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Svensson, why don't you turn on the radio?"
The driver snapped on the radio. A pop song began to play. Something about a breakup. I heard Emma sigh. Noor pressed her hand to her lips and exhaled a ghostly light against the window, where it spread like rolling fog, evanescent, before dissolving back into the air. Hopewell had been something once, but in the present day it was hardly a town anymore. We passed the broken-down ruins of an industrial plant,